When Timothy McVeigh went to his execution, America was left wondering how a decorated war veteran could have done something so evil. Many ask why seemingly good people turn bad. People who, based on all outward evidence, should act properly. The answer lies in understanding our fundamental nature. If you're willing to face the truth, please stay with us. From the Moody Church in Chicago, this is Running to Win with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, whose clear teaching helps us make it across the finish line. Today we begin a series that explains why good people do bad things. Our journey begins with our self-perception. Join us as Dr. Lutzer finds all of us lost in a house of mirrors.
Only God knows who I really am, and may He graciously preserve me from finding out. Those are actually the words of Johann von Goethe, the scholar of the German Enlightenment. Goethe knew that self-discovery is very painful. That's why he preferred if God alone kept his information and preserved him from finding out. What Goethe didn't realize is that if he had been willing to go through that self-examination, if he had been willing indeed to go through that painful self-discovery, maybe his life would have been more fulfilling, and of course he could not have done it without confronting God. Self-perception lies at the root, the very core, of who we are and the way we behave. Give a four-year-old boy a cowboy hat and he will ride every piece of furniture in the house. Give a little girl a doll and she will act like a mother. Marilyn Monroe grew up in a series of homes, a series of foster homes, and was not loved. She felt unlovable. And because she felt that way, she decided to reach out for love in all the ways that she possibly could, and ended up, as others have, finding out that it was the wrong way to pursue love, and she died with an overdose. Or it's like the woman who said to me, "My dad told me I was trash, so I lived out his words and his prophecy." Self-perception determines the way we behave. If that's true, then of course we have to ask the question, what about self-perception? How do we go about discovering who we really are? And even though it's painful, what is the end result? And actually, while we're talking about it, why this disconnect at times between the image that we portray outwardly and the people that we really are privately? Well, as many of you know, this is the beginning in a series of messages titled Why Good People Do Bad Things. And of course, we're going to have to talk about issues such as shame and anger and desires and all of those things so that we better understand ourselves and why you and I could do some very bad things. In effect, what we're going to do is to take a spotlight and to shine it on the human heart. And much of what we uncover is going to be very uncomfortable. But the good news is we're on this journey together. I need to tell you, it's uncomfortable for me too. But we're going to look into the human heart. But we're also going to see the wonder of God's grace and His answer to our most hidden, deceitful ways. Many years ago, I was in a county fair. And I walked into what was called a fun house. It was really the house of mirrors. Very interesting. You've probably been there. You look at one mirror, and I remember I was tall and skinny. Look at another mirror, and I had a very, very big head. Perhaps that one represented reality. But a very big head and a very small torso. And then you walk into another room and the opposite is true. By the time you go through a house of mirrors, what you're really looking for is a flat mirror to remind yourself of who you really are. Now imagine this. There are many people who go around in life and they're spending their whole life trying to find a mirror so that they might know who they really are, so that they have some sense of identity, but there's no way for them to be able to find it because they have not looked into the right mirror. Now, of course, when we speak of mirrors, who is the first mirror that we have that reflects back to us who we are? It is, of course, our parents. If you grew up in a healthy home where you were given the two things that a child needs for a good sense of identity, namely love and respect, you have a much better chance of being able to take those values and putting them into your marriage. You have a much better chance of being a holistic person in the right sense of the word, being able to cope with life, having a good sense of who you are and a good self-concept. Now, the problem with such people, by the way, is they usually make good marriage partners, but they overestimate their own sense of wholeness and goodness. And sometimes they don't have a heart hot for God because in their mind, it's a warped view, but in their mind, they really don't need Him that badly. Now, if you're brought up in an abusive home, talking about alcoholism and where you were undercut and where shame was a part of your existence, if you were brought up in a home like that, you're going to struggle a whole lot more about who you are, and you might end up with what I call the big three: shame, anger, and self-condemnation. Recently, I read of a father who said to his son in anger, "You're nothing more than the product of a one-night fling." Now, you think about that. What the father wanted to do is to destroy that boy, to destroy him at his very core. You know, if he were to take a gun and shoot him, there'd be certain social consequences. But because the boy is still living physically, he wanted to destroy him spiritually, to destroy him at the core of his existence. And think of those words that boy will take into the rest of his life, determining, trying to find out who he is. So we have our parents' enormous impact. So impactful, in fact, that one of the messages I preach in this series is on the role of the father, because your father shapes you in ways that you may not know anything about, and so that's going to be a message in this series. But then, of course, we have teachers and we have others. If you were brought up in a bad home like Dory Vanstone, abused and the like in orphanages, she tells how she used to go to a certain drugstore because there was a kind man there who used to let her have a malt without paying for it. And he used to talk to her in a cheery, helpful way, and she never forgot it. She still talks about it. I wonder, by the way, how many children we sometimes walk by, and they are hurting, and we're not perceptive enough to recognize it. So here's a little window of hope that my home is abusive, but maybe out there somewhere, there might be some kindness, and there might be some love. Well, then we have our parents, we have our teachers, we have other people. If you're married, your partner will certainly help you in your sense of self-perception. And on we could go. But a problem develops. And that problem is, pretty soon, we as children, when we were growing up, discovered something. Namely that we can be one person on the outside and someone else on the inside. And when we discover that, we could be on our journey to deep deception. I'll never forget when I discovered it. I was about 10 or 12 years old, and I had the responsibility of feeding the chickens out on the farm at 5 o'clock every afternoon. Because I had nothing to do, all day to do it in, and nobody to help me, I was fully responsible. Being a last born, I had so much time on my hands, it was just unbelievable. My brothers and sisters had to work, and I just got by with all kinds of things. So I had no excuse. I walked into the garage one day at about 5:30, and my father said, "Did you feed the chickens?" Oh, I didn't want to incur his displeasure, and I felt somewhat embarrassed, so I said, yes, I did. 10 minutes later, I left the garage and went and did what I was supposed to have done a half an hour before. And I remember distinctly saying to myself, this lie really worked. I remember that. In fact, I thought to myself, you know, that means that whenever I'm in a jam, lies actually do work. You know, the Sunday school pupil had a corner on the truth when he said, "A lie is an abomination unto the Lord, but a very present help in time of trouble." There's something to that. Fortunately, my foray into the world of deceit and lying was so short-lived. Because my brother overheard the conversation in the garage, and when he saw me coming back from where the chickens were, he said, "You lied to Dad, didn't you?" And I had to admit I didn't. He said, "Don't you know that God is watching?" Oh, God. Why bring God into this? And I'll tell you, I thank God that that ended my lying career. Do you know what could have happened? I could have told that lie, gotten by with it, and discovered, you know, there's something to this business of deceit, and I could have told another one and more, and then you have people whose whole lives, their whole secret lives become one of deceit, where they are so devious and so cunning because they are fundamentally dishonest. Now, Karl Barth, I think, the great Swiss theologian, was right when he said that we are all incorrigible liars. To some extent, we lie to ourselves, we lie to others, and we lie to God. And that's the kind of thing we hope to uncover in this series of messages. I'll tell you, it is going to be painful for a lot of us. I'm reminded of the words of Sir Walter Scott, who was so right when he said, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." Barth was right that we resist every encroachment of light. There is nothing that we fear more than self-disclosure in the presence of God and in the presence of others, because we hang on to who we are, and our secrets, we want them to remain ours. So you have this discrepancy. On the one hand, there are people who are greedy and selfish, but they desperately want to come across as generous and kind. Ananias and Sapphira lied about the amount that they received from the land. Why? Because they wanted to be well thought of. Sapphira was one of the people in the church. There were deaconesses that were very generous. And so they lied in order not only to hide their sin, but to project an image that was not true of them. And so you have people whose lives are filled with deceit and all kinds of uncleanness. But they come across as people of integrity and are sometimes fastidious. Oh, man, I kind of like that word. Fastidious in their commitment to making sure that they look just right, especially on Sundays and on church occasions. And so you have Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And this summer, in preparation for this series of messages, I finally read that book. All my life I hear about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Well, someday I'm going to tell you about them. And some of you know somebody who perhaps represents them very well. And so there's this disconnect. And then we fall into what is known as denial. And we're told that there are two kinds. The first is conscious denial. That's where I hide things because I know right well that I'm sinning, and so I hide them very carefully. And then you can actually get to the point of unconscious denial, where you actually begin to believe your own lies, and you actually think that lies are reality. Denial. We are such deceptive creatures, aren't we? We tell ourselves lies, and then we begin to believe these lies. Well, this is Pastor Lutzer, and I hope that you continue to join us for this series of messages as we face very, very honestly the question of who we are in the presence of God. And we pray that God shall grant us the grace to admit who we are in His holy and blessed presence.
Dr. Erwin Lutzer introducing his message on Lost in a House of Mirrors. Running to Win comes to you from the Moody Church in Chicago. You're hearing about Why Good People Do Bad Things. This series is now a book, which is our thank you when you give a gift of any amount to support Running to Win. Just call us at 1-800-215-5001. That's 1-800-215-5001. Online, go to offerrtw.com. That's offerrtw, all one word, .com. Or write to Running to Win at Box 11174, Chicago, Illinois 60611. Join us for tomorrow's Running to Win.